back on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to this program a writer for more publications, frankly, than we have time to name. But most recently, writing in the Huffington Post, a piece that I've heard you say was going to come out a little bit later, but sort of in the wake of BuzzFeed putting out a major series on the TPP, you came out with yours, and I think this covers some ground that the BuzzFeed thing may or may not get to. But David Dayan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam.
So, all right, David, let's talk about this. I think, you know, right now, really literally over the past week and a half, we have seen some really interesting things happening as to whether or not the TPP is going to be brought up during the lame duck session. According to Mitch McConnell, not going to happen.
Yeah.
But according to the 28 Democrats who voted for the fast track authority, they'll vote for TPP. Obama going on a campaign style campaign. He must think he's Green Lantern, that he can get this thing going. But with that said, let's talk about the substance. You delved into one aspect of the TPP, which I think my audience is somewhat familiar with, but not this element of it. And that centers around the investor state dispute settlement system. Tell us what that system is.
Right. So investor state dispute settlement is a feature of over 3,000 current trade agreements and investment treaties that are in force currently. So this system is already set up, and it's basically an international arbitration system. Instead of using a court when there is a dispute with an investment treaty or a trade agreement, corporations, foreign investors in countries that have the ability to access this system can go to this extrajudicial tribunal. So they don't go to the local court. If they feel like they are being discriminated against, if they feel like something has violated the trade agreement or violated their treatment, they can go to this court, which is adjudicated by three corporate lawyers who could be working on a case one day and then trying a separate case the next, and they can sue for the loss of expected future profits as a result of whatever treatment was accorded to them.
Let me stop you there and mm-hmm. just dig into this a little more. So is there a place, like is there a an investor state dispute settlement Hague, or when we talk about this process existing, is it just like there is a model, a paradigm that is used and it's...
Right. So the investment chapter of all of these treaties has virtually identical language that says in the event of some violation of a minimum standard of treatment or whatever it is, you can appeal to this process. And this process wasn't actually used very much. This process has been around since the post-war era, since the 50s. And the idea of it was that if, you know, you're set up a factory in a foreign country and the foreign country just grabs the factory, that you would have an appeals process outside of that local court, which is run by that country. So that was sort of the intention behind it. It has morphed, and this is what I talk about in the piece, into a wholly different institution than what the intention was. It now is a way for rich people to make money, basically, to make it the short version. It because this process is available, and the major remedy, the only remedy in the process, is a monetary settlement, and it's an uncapped monetary settlement where that country has to pay and keep paying this corporation for the loss of expected future profits in perpetuity. So because of that reason, speculators have gotten into this. And they do it in a variety of ways.
Before we get into, so give me one more second. Before we get into the means and the speculation, so let's just be clear here. So there is no international civil court, as it were. I mean, we have an international criminal court. People, different countries subscribe to it. I think at this point we don't necessarily subscribe to it for reasons that have to do with the Iraq invasion, as far as I can tell. But there is no international civil court. Is that?
Yeah, well, there is, but not for this specific purpose. So there's the World Trade Organization, which can settle trade disputes from between countries. So there's a country-to-country process where a country on behalf of its corporations could say, hey, you are violating this trade agreement and you're hurting this corporation, and we need to settle that. So that's the WTO. This is where the corporation can sue the country. They don't have to wait for their government to, file some claim on their behalf.
And that's what's distinct too.
The country.
And that's what's distinct too of the TPP versus, let's say, NAFTA or just the WTO. In NAFTA, you started to see this migration where you don't need your own country to bring the action on your behalf.
Well, as I said, this has been in place since the 50s. NAFTA was notable because it was really the first instance of Western developed countries engaging in an agreement with this kind of ISDS system in place. TPP would also further expand that, and then if you do the U.S.-European Union deal, which is known as TTIP, you get from a situation where U.S.-owned assets in foreign countries or foreign countries directly investing in the U.S. is covered right now by maybe 20. ISDS covers maybe 20% of those situations. If you pass TPP and TTIP, it would cover 90% of those situations. So
because presumably in the past,
really blanket it.
Presumably in the past, if you had a claim against the United States government, you could come to a U.S. civil court and file that claim. We are not subject to coups and whatnot, and we have a judiciary that is supposedly independent from what our government officials would do. So in some ways, when you're talking about the United States or Canada or other more developed and stable countries, this is theoretically redundant.
Yeah, theoretically. But the difference is that the rules behind this particular system are far different than a regular court. First of all, there's no transparency. We know of 696 different ISDS cases that have been brought, 10% of those just in the last year, so it's growing as a practice. But even the UN agency that tracks this says we don't know all the cases. They don't have to be publicly made available. The judges do not, they don't have set salaries, they don't have to disclose their ties, there is no transparency around that process. And there's no judicial review, there's no appeals process. The way, when a ruling from the ISDS arbitration panel comes down, it is treated as if it's constitutional law, basically. There are enforcement mechanisms in these treaties to get the countries to pay up if they lose one of these cases. And the awards are very, very large, much larger than you would see in a regular court process. If a corporation challenges the law in a U.S. court, what happens is the law gets overturned. That's what judicial review is. If they challenge it in ISDS, they get a bunch of money. So it's a total different, it's a totally different process and a totally different system. And the fact that it's so centered on monetary awards is why it's led to this speculation.
Okay, so to explain how the speculation runs, because I have seen, I guess, sort of a version of this in the context of tort cases where you have an attorney or a plaintiff who doesn't have the resources, let's say, a company has poisoned the water in this guy's backyard. He doesn't have the money to go against this company, but it's quite clear that if he was to win, he would make a lot of money. So someone else steps in and says, we'll bankroll the lawsuit for 10 or 15% of, or whatever it is. That's the dynamic. Is that, how is that different here?
Yeah, it's similar, and that's, but that's only one component of it. So you have third-party financing, which is what you were talking about, where an investor decides they're going to bankroll the ISDS case in this instance for a corporation, keep it off their books, keep it off their balance sheet, keep it under wraps, keep it secret. Because that third-party relationship doesn't need to be disclosed in any way in the ISDS court, and they get a portion of the profits if it succeeds. However, first of all, there's an entire financial industry based on that. There are litigation finance firms that are participating in this process, and they say that arbitration claims against a foreign sovereign government are among the fastest growing aspects of the business. So you have this, and usually who the people are doing the investing are hedge funds, private equity firms, institutional investors. But there's another aspect to this where the hedge funds or the private equity firms eliminate the middleman. They just go ahead and buy a company that they think is going to have an ISDS claim in the future. And they buy a major stake in it, and then they bring the claim, even though in most of the cases, years after the conduct had already started. So the examples I give in the piece are there was a case against Greece that was made by a Slovakian bank that bought up Greek bonds and then said, well, the value of our Greek bonds went down, and that's discriminatory, so we want money for the rest of the value of the bonds. Well, the Greek bonds had been falling for years before that Slovakian bank bought those bonds. So that this was a strategy of theirs that we're going to buy these bonds and our backstop for the value of them is to use this extrajudicial process through a trade agreement that Slovakia has with Greece, and we're going to use that in order to make a bunch of money. You saw the same thing in Spain, where two subsidiaries, investment firm subsidiaries of major global banks, purchased shares in solar companies, solar power plants. 3 years after Spain, because of its financial crisis, started rolling back its solar subsidies. So they knew that they weren't getting the solar subsidies. There was a rollback in place, and the rollback continued. But they sued in the ISDS courts to say, hey, we didn't know that those solar subsidies were going away, and that's a change and a violation, and we're going to have to, you know, get back our expected future profits. So it's not just third-party financing. It's first-party financing, I guess you could call it. It's purchasing a company for the sole purpose of using this process to make money.
So the real, so this is interesting because we've talked about the concept of I'm a drug manufacturer and I am selling drugs to the United States. And then all of a sudden we get single payer and they start negotiating prices down on those drugs. And I complain, you have cost me future profits. In this instance, someone could show up a year after a single payer has been instituted and say, like, We're gonna pursue this loss essentially because we know we're gonna make up three times that loss by suing essentially.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and it leads to a lot of speculative business where the people who are getting rewarded by this process aren't the ones who actually invested in the foreign country, who created jobs, created a factory. It's just the financial industry using it as an asset strategy. And you can see all sorts of implications from that, whether they use a secondary market to make this ISDS claim into a tradable asset.
Right, securities, right? They do this with lawsuits now, but at least in the context of the lawsuits, there's an actual loss, and it is not the defendant in this case is not the taxpayer, right? I mean, because all of this money, if I go and I sue the United States government because you went and instituted single-payer health care, and I had anticipated, you know, I hadn't taken any moves in that direction, but generally speaking, I had anticipated the, you know, billions of dollars in profits on these drugs that are now the profit margins much lower. I sue you, and basically the taxpayer's got to pay for the benefit that their government has given them twice.
And, yes. And typically the governments that are subject to this thing, you see a lot of piling on that goes on. And it's usually governments that are in a distressed position that can't really fight back. The number one country that has been subject to ISDS cases is Argentina. And most of them are around the emergency measures that they put in when they were in an economic crisis. And the companies that were invested in there that had the ability to bring a case said that, oh, those emergency measures cut into my profits and you're going to have to pay me. And they have paid almost $1 billion to corporations over ISDS cases. And you see that they just sort of go around the world and they find these trouble spots. And it's Greece and it's Spain and it's and maybe next it's Puerto Rico and maybe next it's Detroit or Illinois, because it's not just federal laws that are at issue here. It's state and local ones. So if you expand the ISDS process through TPP and give more countries like Japan and Australia and you know, countries that have a lot of multinational corporations, you give them the ability to sue the U.S. in these special courts, you're opening up any kind of trouble spot in the country to a tremendous amount of risk, and that's risk to the taxpayer.
And it's interesting. I mean, it's just one more element of what is problematic of the TPP, because this dynamic exists. It's just that you're serving up a whole nother, I guess, petri dish in which this stuff can really.
It's a whole other dimension that turns this dispute resolution system into a casino gaming parlor. And that is extremely problematic in my view. And it's not necessary, let's also add. I mean, these are large corporations investing abroad. Traditionally, what you would do in that instance is if you were worried that you were going to be discriminated or expropriated, you'd buy insurance. And, that risk would be offloaded onto another private company. But now the insurance is the taxpayer of that country. So the risk has been socialized effectively, and this guarantees that they get a minimum certain level of profit, these corporations and these speculators, these financiers who are coming in and abusing the process.
And we should say that when an insurance company insures you, they have someone come out and investigate your claim. In this instance, right, there's no representative of those who would have to pay.
There sort of is. The way it works is that there's an arbitration panel of three judges. And the one judge is picked by the corporation, one judge is picked by the company, and then they agree on the third judge.
By the country. One is by the country.
The country does get to pick one of the three judges, and then they agree on the third. However, one of the things that, the U.S. Trade Representative and defenders of the system say is that, companies only win a quarter of these cases. First of all, that's only the cases we know about that have been publicly disclosed. And second of all, that doesn't include the cases where the countries settle, where there are undisclosed terms of monetary value given in. If you throw out the cases where jurisdiction they say, we don't have the jurisdiction to hear this case because you're not, based in the country you say you are or whatever it is. You throw out those, and it's a fairly large majority of these cases get decided on behalf of the corporation. And even threatening to bring the case can have a chilling effect. which you know, basically gets in the heads of regulators and says this is going to cost us a lot of money if in legal fees if we go ahead and we don't have access to a litigation finance system like
right.
These corporations do. So it's going to cost us a lot of money, so we better not pass that law, or we better not change that regulation.
Right. There's a chilling effect. I mean, we've seen a dynamic like that basically with Dodd-Frank in some respects, and we see it with the EPA, and we see this all the time. And all right, so two more questions, and then I know you got to run. All right, so won't also, I mean, isn't it also, I should say, not necessarily predictive of what the rate of success of these corporations pursuing an ISDS claim is, because the TPP could, or it appears that will, institute a new set of rules, I guess, that will be more favorable to those plaintiffs going forward.
It expands the system. Right now, the U.S. has ISDS triggered in bilateral deals with, like, Costa Rica. You know, Costa Rican companies are not super prevalent in the United States.
Right.
But when you expand that deal to include Australia and all their shipping companies, or Japan and all their banks, it's a completely different scenario. And I might add, that TPP was a real jackpot for the financial services industry with respect to ISDS, because they got the ability to sue under the most flexible standard, which is called the minimum standard of treatment. And that means that if that bank, that financial services company, isn't accorded the minimum standard of treatment, then they can say that you know, you, the United States, are discriminating against us. And so now you've opened up foreign banks for the ability to you know, sue in these special courts. And if you're talking about Japan, well, you know, every Swiss bank has a subsidiary in Japan. Every U.S. bank, mega bank, has a subsidiary in Japan. They can use those subsidiares. We've seen that many
times. Those subsidiaries basically just
venue shopping. Philip Morris wanted to sue Australia over those cigarette regulations that they made, but U.S. and Australia didn't have a deal, so they used a Hong Kong subsidiary and sued under the Hong Kong-Australia Investment Treaty. So this happens all the time, really. This happens where the venues change, and often the arbitrators just wave that through and let that go forward.
All right, so lastly, is there, I mean, you know, there's, it's interesting to try and pin down the arguments for the TPP, because you have economists come out and say, like, this is really not even a trade deal.
Right.
And then, you know, there is some argument as, like, we're trying this Asian pivot, and if we don't, you know, and this is part of turning to Asia, as if, you know, the fact that we've moved our entire Navy into the Pacific is not enough of an indication, right? We need to have this protection for pharmaceuticals and
right.
And whatnot. And then there are some who argue that, like, look, the president has gone out on a limb. We need to pass this to save face, all that stuff. Has there been also, like, a lobby behind, like, is there a significant lobby out there going, like, this is going to be a cash cow for us? Like, this is going to be we're going to open up another desk in our business, and it's just going to be this. And so we're going to lobby hard for this.
I mean, I haven't seen definitive evidence of that. What I do know is that the industry that is, you know, engaging in third-party finance is very happy about the recent drift toward investment arbitration. They're making a lot of money off these cases. And so anything that expands it, I assume they would be perfectly fine with. What's interesting is that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as we know, is a big, big supporter of the TPP. However, they're a huge opponent of third-party financing, because often it gets used to file commercial claims against some of their members.
Right.
So they're in this weird position where they're defending the ISDS system, but completely opposed to this system of litigation finance, which has sprung up around the ISDS system.
I'm sure that they can figure out a way of just saying, like, it's one thing to finance corporations, you know, B2B is much different than it would be to finance the lawsuit of an individual.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
David Dayan, I know that you're pressed for time. I know you've been up for a while. I really appreciate you spending some time with us.
All right. Thanks a lot.